We are in the WGXC studio with two fantastic writers. I just went to the Omai International Arts Center and went to you guys' reading on Saturday. I'm joined by Ayobami Adebayo. Could you please pronounce it?
Ayobami Adebayo.
Hi, welcome. Also, Nadia Davids.
Hi, hello.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having us.
It's nice to be here.
Today we're also here with Ruth Adam, the administrative director of OMAI. And on Saturday, you opened up the reading, and then W.D. Gibson, the director of the Writers OMAI, followed suit, kind of giving a little preface to what the residency you guys are currently doing is all about. The center houses artists of all discipline all year round, but right now it's the writers. And there's also visual artists, dancers, musicians, everything. And you guys are with 10 writers now?
I think there are about 8 writers at the moment.
Yeah.
And they're anywhere from screenwriters, novelists, poets?
There are many novelists and nonfiction writers at the moment, yeah. And they're all remarkable from a really, really wide range of people from Romania to the US.
Mm-hmm. And I think we have a translator.
Yes.
Yeah. From the
yes.
Netherlands.
That's yes.
Right, that's correct.
So it's primarily an international program. So you have maybe 2 to 4 Americans, and then the rest are an international body.
Yeah.
Fantastic. So how I wanted to structure this was, we have the rare opportunity of having you guys here. You guys have fantastic speaking voices. It would be great if you wanted to read an excerpt from your upcoming novels. Do they have titles? Or
yeah, mine's called The Blessing.
And mine is called Stay With Me.
Nadia, how about we begin with you? And if you wouldn't mind reading an excerpt, and then we'll discuss it a little bit.
Right, this comes from, this is actually the first page. I'm just going to read the first 2 paragraphs. The novel, can I talk a little bit about where it's set? And okay, great. So it's set in 2 periods in South Africa, in Cape Town. The first is in 1993, which is a year before the first democratic elections in the country. So it's a very, very sort of fraught and tempestuous and tumultuous time. Very exciting and very exhilarating, but it's also the country could sort of go a number of different ways. And what I'm interested in this novel is sort of exploring how ordinary people respond to quite extraordinary circumstances. And I think in the tradition of South African literature, very, very often what happens is that we tend to focus on the quite large, grand national narratives and trying to sort of think a little bit about the smaller stories and what happens when you have a coming of age story taking place. So there are 2 characters. The one is someone who's about 14 in 93, a girl, and the other is a 26-year-old man who's her uncle. Who has his own sort of process going on. But this is from the opening page. It was her longest summer yet, and it had been almost without wind. For the months of November to February to be filled with days of warm stillness, unhurried by what always began innocuously, a small sigh and nothing, and then abruptly a full-skied shriek was as rare as it was loved. A windless summer, Alia thought, remembering how often she'd said those words as prayer, not as fact. Hers was a city of winds and storm, of fierce sun and chilling fog, of long cold rains and terrible droughts, of unexpected hails and gales, and sometimes all those things in one day. A city of unease, Cape Town, a moody city, a place of rock and water, rock and water. The mountain and the sea had long ago decided and redecided its shape, but history had pushed back at the natural rim of the coast and formed a place out of careful division. Alia lived in a neighborhood called Warmer Estate, a small universe at the foot of Table Mountain. The streets ran on long, steep slopes bound for the harbor, and the homes that ran beside them tilted forward as though they were being tugged by an invisible pulley. Warmer Estate was full of opposites. It was a place of large, light-filled houses and stingy gardens, of overcrowded, smelly flats and open fields, of little girls in burqas hurrying down sharp hills to madrasa, and teenage boys clustered outside corner shops, smoking cigarettes, admiring each other's sneakers and contraband denim. It was where wind-stunted shrubs and stooped trees leaned gratefully against 5-feet-tall graffiti commands to defy the state, where women sat on old stoops in faded house dresses saying terrible things about their neighbors one day and weeping like hired Greek mourners at their funerals the next. It was where men never quite outgrew those first longings for German engineering, and that rite of passage, the purchase of a Mercedes-Benz, new or used, could happen well into middle age. Its residents were often accused of nurturing a certain arrogance. Living on a hill, any hill will do that to you. But Alia thought it was more than that. The hills were one thing, the wind was another. She believed it made them all mad and tough. Mad and tough.
Thank you so much. And as it progresses, it goes into a story of two houses that are implicated by the weather, and then it culminates in a fire of sorts.
Yeah.
And what was very interesting, you go through all these strong dichotomies of 30-year rivalry between these two houses.
Yeah.
And it ends up, if I am allowed to say, that they end up being of the same blood.
Yeah, they're the same family. The
same family.
Yeah. Yeah.
Could you talk about what brought you to write a story like this? Or could you talk a little bit about the background of the story?
Well, I mean, I'm just really interested in this time period. And I suppose it was because part of my growing up was in the 80s in South Africa. And it was just a very, very kind of tempestuous and interesting time. And then I think more specifically, I'm interested about the community I grew up in, which was a Muslim community in Cape Town, and had, I think it's not necessarily a particularly well-known story. I think when people think about the narrative of the country, they think about it quite explicitly in a particular way. And this is a very old community. Its inception sort of coincides with the beginning of the city. These are people who were brought down as part of the slave trade, the Dutch East India slave trade, 350 years ago. Hmm. So it's, you know, the whole kind of the tapestry of that community is woven in to the tapestry of the city. And I didn't really think about the kind of metaphorical meanings of these two families locked in a no-speaking spell. It's just something that would happen in that city, I think. In your city, too.
Yeah,
yeah, people would be locked in no-speaking spells next to each other. Yeah, but maybe there is an extra layer in there.
I read Long Walk to Freedom, the biography by Nelson Mandela. After he got out of prison, there was such tumultuous... I mean, you have Mr. D. Klerk, who is the national leader, working in tandem and then also in conflict with Nelson Mandela. And then the surrounding months leading up to the election, a lot of tumultuous periods.
It was an extraordinary time, because, I mean, I think at some level, I think we were, you know, there were several moments. And one of the pieces that the novel talks about is this moment when a really important and dynamic and charismatic leader of the South African Communist Party called Chris Hani was assassinated. And at that point, you know, the country sort of dangerously trembled on the precipice of another civil war. And I don't know that people understood just how, outside of the country, understood just how, you know, cataclysmic that moment was, and just how much the ANC had to compromise, and how difficult sitting down at that negotiating table actually was. And I think that today, you know, I'm not sure that that sacrifice is fully understood or appreciated in the way that maybe it should be.
And to pull that back into your previous work, Nadia, you also are a playwright. You've written several plays, At Her Feet and Sissy Ghoul.
Yeah, that's right. Yep.
And I'm actually interested in Sissy Ghoul specifically, segueing in, because that was from the 6th District.
Yeah, District 6.
District 6.
Yeah. Yeah.
Could you talk, because you have your origins... Or some of your family member?
Yeah, I think both my family, both my mother and my father's family lived in this neighborhood, and it was very interesting kind of ex-slave population, but also drawn from merchants and laborers and built up in the 1900s, late 1800s, 1900s in Cape Town. It was a multicultural, multiracial, multi-religious area, and it was destroyed under the Group Areas Act in 1966, where everybody was pretty much forcibly removed. I think they removed about 60,000 people. It took 10 years into the outlying Cape Flats ghetto areas. And the reason that they did that was, the reason that the South African government did that was because, I think there were two reasons. They managed to seize potentially very expensive real estate, which was close to the city center. But then at a psychic level, they also managed to erase this place with the history of successful intercultural, interracial existence, which is a direct threat to a government predicated on segregation. So it was in their best interest, I suppose, to get rid of it. And this woman that I wrote the play about was from this neighborhood, and she was a very interesting political activist. She was an anti-imperialist, and she was a feminist way before it was easy or fashionable to be one. She was, strong and tough and great, and so I thought I should write a play about her, and I did.
And you wrote the play from a very interesting perspective, that it was a lot of the characters were... In the form of like an archive, giving character testimonies.
Yeah, you really did look
I thought it was really interesting.
Yeah. Well, that was playing with the whole idea. Yeah, it was done to kind of think about the play as being part of a larger archive for the country as well. And it was also playing into the whole idea of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, where for a long time in South Africa, the idea of history was a very fragile and sort of tentative thing, because the history that we would see written in books was certainly not the history that everybody was experiencing. And so after the end of apartheid, when people were sort of able to come forward and testify and give their stories, this was really it wasn't merely about kind of gathering testimony, it was also kind of getting stuff that would go towards reparations. It was also about rewriting a history and kind of reconstructing an archive. So mm-hmm. yeah. So the play, I think, was kind of trying to aestheticize some of that and find ways to make it kind of human and tangible and mm-hmm. yeah.
So you were living in South mm-hmm. Africa but now you live in London.
Now I lived in New York for 5 years as well. But now I live in London. I teach at the University of London at Queen Mary.
Has that transition, no longer living there, affected your work?
I'm sure it has in all kinds of terrible ways. I mean, I do miss home terribly, and I try and get back as frequently as I can. But I think that it's probably both affected it in that I'm not in touch with the day-to-day things that happen at home anymore. And so the texture and my understanding of the kind of, I think, some of the complexities of what happens at home has changed. But at the same time, it's kind of elongated my perspective, and so now I'm interested in conversations between these things in a way that maybe I wouldn't have been if I'd just been at home. There's that too. Mm-hmm. I think travel, I mean, in any way, I think living away from home expands your capacity, well, mine anyway, to kind of connect stories instead of just thinking that it's a single story.
Fantastic.
Cool. Thank you for having us and for looking into all of that stuff.
Absolutely. I would love to segue into Ayobami. Can you read an excerpt from...
All right. I'll just read the first part of a particular chapter. And let me just give a background to the whole work. The protagonist in this section of the novel is a woman who has been married for about 5 years. She's in her 30s and she doesn't have a child. And back home, if you don't have a child, whether you are a man or a woman, and you grow old and die, they say that you're like a snake that passed on a rock and there's no imprint. It's like you were never here. So it's something that is very important. And she's at this point where she's desperate and her husband has married a second wife, but he has been kind enough, if we can put it that way, to sort of sequester the other wife outside the family house. So she's still living alone with her husband, but she knows that there's this woman outside who can come in at any time. So she's here in this scene to visit her mother-in-law, who is a go-to person on miracles and all sort of things that could get her pregnant. So mm-hmm. I'll just go into that. "Are you pregnant now?" my mother-in-law asked. I scratched my head. "Are you barren and deaf too? What are you saying? Are you pregnant?" The answer is either, yes, I am pregnant, or no, I still haven't been pregnant for a single day in my life. "I don't know," I said. I stood up and backed away till she was not within the reach of my clenched fist. "Why won't you allow my son to have a child?" She stood up. "I don't manufacture children," I said. "God does." She marched towards me. She spoke when her bare toes were touching the tips of my shoes. "Have you ever seen God in a labor room giving birth to a child? Tell me. Women manufacture children. And if you can't, you're just a man. No one should even call you a woman." She gripped my wrist and lowered her voice. "This life is not difficult, Yejide. If you cannot have children, allow my son to have some with Kike. We're not asking you to stand up from your place in his life. We're just saying you should shift so someone else can sit down." "I'm not stopping him, Mommy," I said. "I've accepted her. She even spent the weekends in our house." My mother-in-law laughed. "I'm a woman too. And I wasn't born yesterday. Why has Yomi never touched Kike? He has been married to her for 2 months. Tell me why he has not removed her wrapper once." "It is not my business what Yomi does with his wife," I said, stifling a smile. She lifted my blouse and laid a wrinkled palm on my stomach. "Flat as the side of a wall," she said. "You have had my son between your legs for 2 more months, and still, your stomach is flat. I beg you, we both know how he feels about you. If you don't chase him away, he won't even touch Kike. If you don't, he will die childless. Is that what you want? I beg you, don't spoil my life. He's my first son, Yejide. Don't use your own miserable life to spoil mine. I closed my eyes, but tears still forced their way past my eyelids. I've been good to you, Yejide, my mother-in-law said. I beg you in the name of God, be good to me. She held me then, pulled me into her arms, muttered words of comfort. Her embrace held no warmth. Her words sat in my stomach, cold and hard, where her baby should have been.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The part where she holds her stomach and it's flat as a wall, I think that's such a beautiful imagery, and it sort of brings the whole...
Oh, thank you. But it's something that can happen.
So you were born and raised in Nigeria.
Yes.
And could you go into why you chose this subject matter for... This is an upcoming novel?
Yes, yeah. I think I was just fascinated by how somehow, because I've already established that children, it's a big deal to have children. It's almost... I don't think I've ever met any couple who said they weren't going to have children. Usually by the time you've been married for a year or two, people are sort of looking at your stomach to see that you're pregnant, or, I mean, after 2 years, it's like, oh, we need to pray so that she can get pregnant. But what sort of fascinated me about all of it was how it was instantly the woman's fault. It was instantly that there was something wrong with her. It was strange to me. There are two people in this relationship. Why are you always fixating on one person? I think that was one of the things that was bugging my mind, and how somehow it would usually become the woman's burden. It would become a problem. Should be the one going to the hospital, going to the pastor, going from place to place. And it was as if she was supposed to have some kind of immaculate conception. And I don't know. The way people just kind of zeroed out the man. Nobody questioned whether it was fatal or not, whether there was something wrong or not. No, it had to be the woman.
And also the interesting dynamic between the mother-in-law seeming as if she knew what was right for the wife, and saying that if you can't provide my son with a child, then step aside and allow him to attempt with another wife.
Yes, I think that particular relationship between Yejide and her mother-in-law was peculiar, in that Yejide had lost her own mother. And in those kind of situations, your mother is kind of your refuge. I mean, she's the person you go to. But they are in this situation where a mother-in-law is like our friend. But of course, the woman is looking out for her own son's interests. So it's a very dicey situation. And there is a sense in which they're being kind. If you look at what could have happened, in that the mother-in-law is coming from the perspective of, I'm not telling you to get out. You've been here for 5 years, you don't have any child. I'm not telling you to get out. I mean, to the mother-in-law from the generation that she comes from, she's been very kind. And she's thinking, why is this so difficult for you to accept? You know. So the perspective from which the mother-in-law is coming from, as far as she's concerned, she's doing all she can to make this easy for this woman.
Yeah. And as you continue with the story, you went into this really beautiful but also slightly scary ritual experience where she subjects herself to a bunch of bearded men,
yes,
correct?
Yeah.
And they are trying to do some type of ritual performance that will, in fact, make her fertile.
Yes, and get her pregnant instantly. Yes, I think that at that point, a number of things have happened. And I think for her, it was really the pressure. In that scene, she's telling herself, oh, these people are crazy. But then she sort of subjects herself to that. The fact that this woman has been brought up to think that she has to have children, that is what will validate her existence. And she's surrounded by the situation where she has become convinced that there's something wrong with her. And now her husband has a new wife. So she's in a situation where she's making decisions that she probably wouldn't have imagined that she would have made. And it's something that happens, that when all of this happens, women do things that you wouldn't imagine, that they wouldn't imagine that they will do, with their level of education, their exposure and all that.
Did you pull from a lot of personal histories, or like, is this something that you discuss with friends? How much is this on your personal radar, or your cultural radar?
I think that on my personal radar, not very much. But on the cultural radar, yes, it's there. I mean, you turn on the radio and you hear people talking about things like this. You have a cousin who did this. You are in the hostel and you have a roommate whose mother was sent out of the family house by her husband because she didn't have any boys, because that is also an issue. So it was there, but it was also something that I discussed with a number of people, my mother, people who were older and had children and sort of had some experience in dealing with in-laws and all that.
You also are an editor, correct?
Yeah.
Of which publication?
Saraba.
Saraba.
Yeah.
And that's in Nigeria?
Yes, it is. Yeah.
And you also facilitate writing workshops, or in terms of like you try to galvanize the writing community?
Yes. Yeah. I wouldn't say that I facilitate workshops. I think we just try to bring other people who write together so that we can talk and share information. And it sort of gets lonely in the sense that, I don't know, you sort of feel you're alone and you're doing this thing. It's not such an industry, if I can use that word. Mm-hmm. So the idea behind the workshops we've had has been to get other people in the university who are writing to come together so that we can network, talk about our writing, read what we've written and critique each other. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so coming to Omai and being around a bunch of international writers, how has the experience been?
It's been very wonderful. Yeah, yeah. It's quite fascinating to see people from different countries. We have very interesting dinner conversations.
Can
very
imagine.
Interesting dinner conversations. And to see, I think, like Nadia was saying, being away from home, I think there's a way it clarifies your vision in the sense that you're sort of standing outside. And while you're at home, you read and you watch the news, you watch TV. You know that elsewhere, it's not the way it is at home. But actually going outside and looking at other people and seeing that, I mean, this is still human beings and they do things so differently. It's, I think, kind of influenced the way I see things now.
How long will you be at the residency for at Omai?
I've been there since April 30. I'll be there till May 30. So
a whole month.
I'm doing a month, yeah.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you guys were able to come to Hudson, and you should check it out because it's close to Ghent where you guys are located.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you so much for reading from your upcoming novels. Yours was called Blessing.
The Blessing. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The Blessing. And do you have
Stay With Me.
Stay With Me.
Yeah.
Well, thanks so much for coming
on
the show.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.